Hello, everyone. Welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, March 28th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, I'm going to talk a little about a new movie called Death of a Unicorn, and I'll present an interview with that film's writer-director, Alex Sharfman. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and it is just me on today's episode. I wanted to tell you all a little about Death of a Unicorn, which I was very excited to see when I saw its trailer several weeks ago. This is another Eat the Rich movie in a growing lineage of others that we've seen and discussed on the podcast within the past few years. But this one introduces a supernatural element in the form of unicorns. So Paul Rudd and Jenna Ortega play a father and daughter who are driving up to an isolated mansion, and they accidentally hit a unicorn on the way there. And for plot reasons, they throw it in the back of their car, they complete the drive, and as Rudd's lawyer character is trying to get himself into the good graces of this ultra-rich family, which is comprised of Richard E. Grant, Taya Leone, and Will Poulter, the revived unicorn breaks out and goes on a rampage. So that's kind of the setup. There's some pretty good stuff here. We're going to have an article up on slashfilm.com today about some creature Easter eggs that appear throughout the movie, so you can check that out if you're interested. Will Poulter in particular is really fun to watch, leaning into playing an oblivious fail son who has massive amounts of unearned confidence. People like Anthony Carrigan, who played NoHo Hank on Barry, and Sunita Mani, who is on Glow, are very entertaining in small supporting roles. But for me, the movie becomes a little repetitive, and ultimately its biggest problem is the thing that separates it from all of its contemporaries, the unicorns. It reminds me of how Steven Spielberg got extremely lucky when the shark wasn't working on Jaws, and that forced him into the approach of not showing the creature nearly as much as he initially planned. This film has a lot of unicorn action, and unfortunately, it just feels like the CG wasn't there. Your mileage may vary on that, but I personally thought they looked pretty rough, which was a real bummer because the movie relies heavily on them throughout the story. You see them a lot. But I was still interested to talk to Alex Sharfman, the writer-director, because this is his first feature film, and it's a big A24 release with major stars in it. So I wanted to ask him about how he managed to cast these folks and the cinematic inspirations that he had, and working with Larry Fong, the cinematographer who shot The Lost pilot and movies like 300, Super 8, Batman vs. Superman, and Kong Skull Island, and a bunch of other stuff. So here is my conversation with writer-director Alex Sharfman. I was looking at your IMDb earlier, and you co-directed a short film in 2010, and you've produced a handful of features since then, including Resurrection, which I really liked. But with so little directing experience, how did you convince all of these huge actors to be in this movie?
It's an interesting question. How did I convince them to be in the movie? I've been working as a producer for a number of years now, and I've produced, like, I should know the answer. I think I've produced 7 or 8 features, and I've executive produced a bunch more and worked as an executive on them. But with all the features that I produced, I was always the person standing right next to the director, you know, at monitor, helping figure out the shots, figuring out the coverage, figuring out, did we get it? Do we need something else? And, you know, separate from that, I've been working as a screenwriter for a few years as well. So, you know, and it's funny with there's a bunch of scripts that I had written that I'd never that I didn't intend to direct and that were in development and still are in development with other directors. But something that I kept running into is people being like, this feels like it's for a writer director. And so I don't know what that is exactly, because other people tell me that. And that's not something I would have said at the outset. But I do think there's something of a certain, I don't know, specificity of voice, perhaps, that implies, or of intention, or, you know, I always try to keep my scripts having a pretty specific perspective, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And communicating that is in a way that feels very, you know, I don't know, specific, for lack of a better word. And so I think that sort of led to people reading the script and kind of understanding the intention behind it. So, you know, it was that. And, like, to be honest, I prepared a shit ton. Like, I, you know, in terms of casting the movie, we had the studio on board well before that. But in order to get the studio to greenlight the movie, I needed to storyboard all the creature shots so we could budget all the creature shots so we could figure out everything that cost. And then for me, I realized I couldn't storyboard the creature shots unless I shotlisted the creature shots, and I couldn't shotlist the creature shots unless I'd shotlisted the whole movie, and I couldn't shotlist the whole movie unless I built a floor plan of the house to understand the blocking. And so that's like, I ended up with, the whole movie shotlisted like a year and a half before we ended up shooting. Of course, it changed, but there was definitely like just, a, and then, in order to do that, you come up with lookbooks. And so it was just like, we did creature concept art to sort of figure out what the creatures were looking like. We did a lot of creature design preliminarily. So by the time we were into casting, I just had like so much material. I'd just been living in the movie in my head for a long time. So I don't know. I think all that helped, and just having a specificity on the page, and then all these documents that are like, what do you want to see? I got it. And I'm a very I try to be a very transparent collaborator. So if someone wants something, I'll probably give them more shit than they want to look at. So yeah, I guess I think that kind of all added up to a sense of, and again, just like I came from a producing and production background. So I think the biggest thing I think with first feature directors as from my producing perspective is like, do you have something to say? Do you have an original script and something interesting that's like of a perspective? And then the next thing is like, can you physically do the thing? Like making movies is a really weird like action. It's like a difficult activity that is very specific circumstances, and a lot of people don't like that environment. I knew that I felt very comfortable in that world. I enjoy it. It's a weird problem-solving, creativity, collaborative space that I like just enjoy inhabiting.
Yeah. So this may be an indelicate question, so forgive me if I'm like crossing a line or anything, but I'm just curious on like a practical level. You're talking about all that work that you did before the movie in terms of coming up with the blueprint for the house and all that kind of stuff. Is all of that like unpaid work? Are you just essentially doing that on spec in the hopes that the studio will green light your movie? I'm just trying to get a sense for people who might be out there who want to be, first time directors. Like, what can they expect in terms of that side of things?
Yeah, I mean, that's not like, like professionally speaking, I was engaged as a writer on this and then as a director, but that's all directing work that I did. As a director, like you don't get paid until the movie's greenlit, basically. At least in my deal. And maybe some days I won't be. I'll be like, hey, you're attached, great. But no, I mean that work was yeah, I mean not done on spec because I was working with A24 on all of it. But there's a degree to which, I've written two scripts that are set in one house. And the first one that I wrote, I modeled it on a house of someone I knew when I was growing up. And so I had that map in my head. And this house, I didn't know anyone who lived in a house like this at any point in my life. So I did a lot of research on Airbnbs and like looking at like, looking at, I was like going to like Montana and Airbnb and looking at like, what's the most expensive house you could rent in Montana for a weekend or whatever, or like looking up photos and Architectural Digest of like, luxury ranches in the West. And so I started with that, and then I did like a very crude rudimentary drawing of the house because I knew the way the movie worked, I needed to understand the geography of the house, in order to write it, and how people would move around through it. And so I just had like a very crude rudimentary drawing that I used for the writing process. And my wife happens to be an architect, and she saw me one day with my terrible drawing, and she was like, okay, I'm gonna build you a model. And so she did that, a very, very like which but then our production designer took over and changed a bunch and made it her own, and found all these great new angles and design ideas and things like that. But that was all like, some of that was just part of my writing process, so I
Right.
needed to do it. But yeah, I mean, from a like nuts, bolts, dollars, cents thing, like no one was paying me to do that. But I kind of had the feeling that if I didn't do it and I didn't prove a certain, it's so tough. You want everything to feel undeniable, when you're trying to make something as a director, and you want it to be big and ambitious and take a big swing, it's a huge risk. And as much as you can make people feel like, oh, this isn't as risky as it seems on paper,
Yeah.
And yeah, ultimately no one was going to pay me to do that.
Right. So, as a first-time feature director, how did you handle working with all of these actors? Because I'm guessing several of them probably have different ways that they like to work and approach their craft. So, how did you go about, I guess, optimizing all of that into an experience that worked for everybody?
I mean, I wish I could say there was more process to it than like when you meet with actors, you kind of get a vibe and get a sense, and you talk about how you want to make the movie. And if people click with that, that's a good sign. With all of our actors, I talk a lot about the theatricality of the movie. I really like that the movie plays in a lot of wides and two shots and three shots, not like single, 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 like that kind of
Yes.
me. And I think that doesn't work particularly well for a single location movie like this. And it doesn't like lean into the ensemble fun of what it is that makes these sort of movies entertaining. So, that was just something I was very transparent about of like, this is what I want to do. Like, are you into this? And everyone was. And we got really lucky. Casting director A.B. Kaufman is just like a genius and really had a brilliant sense of how to help build the ensemble with me. And, I mean, yeah, there's some you figure out like who, some actor, everyone has their own little things of like who likes to start slow and build and who's like first three takes are the best and then diminishing returns. And I think that you just kind of get a feel for. But to be honest, I was an embarrassment of riches on the acting front in this movie. And I didn't have to like I wasn't like managing any of that in any kind of like heavily conscious way, more so than, I mean, the truth is, I don't tend to love getting too many takes unless I really think we need it, and the actors all were just incredible. It was a really fortunate circumstance.
Yeah, they're so awesome. So I know that you looked at a bunch of folklore involving unicorns when you were writing this, but what kind of cinematic inspirations did you have when it came time to actually shoot this thing?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of different things that went into this movie. Like, I mean, there's the obvious. I would say the biggest influence was like, in terms of marrying the folklore, like the thing that got me very excited when at a conceptual level was saying, okay, this is gonna be a modernization, a recontextualization, a synthesis of unicorn lore from antiquity, specifically from the Middle Ages, and recontextualize into the structure of a creature feature, specifically of like the late 70s to the 90s. And so there's a lot of movies that speaks to, that's like Jaws, that's Jurassic Park, that's Alien, Aliens, The Thing, but I think there's like a really great rich, The Abyss is another one that I love. There's also like, the Shaun of the Dead's Attack the Block of a more recent era that is more, tilted towards comedy in a way that I think is fun and has a consciousness of like its lineage, its history. But there's also more classic ones that you go back to that I think, Creature from the Black Lagoon. Like, has anyone made a better monster movie? I don't know. The Abominable Snowman by Val Guest is a movie that I love. Romero's Night of the Living Dead is in like perfect movie. So I don't know. There's a lot of things that I was thinking about. And then the other thing that like superimposes on top of that to me is, kind of classic class satires like Jean Renoir's Règle du jeu. And Louis Buñuel's Exterminating Angel are movies that I like think about a lot as like rich people in heightened circumstances. Like, I think there's actually a lot more that those movies have in common with a movie like Jurassic Park than people think of like, oh yeah, it's an ensemble of people. Chaos is escalating. The social order, the rules that you come into the movie expecting are devolving. And these people are sort of in this crisis. So I don't know. It's funny to say that, but like, well, God, I also think a lot about like the first half of like High and Low by Akira Kurosawa. Like, just like, oh, fun blocking, moral quandaries. That might not be something that anyone sees in the movie but me, but that was helpful for me to like think about blocking, think about that sort of stuff. And then, there's a lot of, and I'm like looking at like a list. I'm like, what else is there? Like, I don't know. It's like Evil Dead. Like, it's hard not to be, there's all of that stuff in the 80s too, of like Evil Dead, John Landis with American Werewolf in London. Like, there's so many like fun, that when you start getting into creature movies and then, there's so many fun references. But I do like when you get to like overlay, like, okay, creature, class satire, and what are the points where that's like, when you, sorry, this is very tangential, but it's how I think about it of like, with waveforms, and like physics, there's like constructive interference and destructive interference. Like, you can time two waveforms or build two waveforms so that they totally negate each other, but you can also time and build two waveforms so that they double each other's height, And so it's like, well, what's the constructive interference version of like this genre and that genre, and how do we make them like whoop, now they're playing together,
Now you're speaking my language. I've never heard anybody put it that way, but that's a really fascinating sort of visualization of that. That's very cool. So tell me about working with Larry Fong, who is sort of a rock star DP. I mean, I know a handful of cinematographers by name, and he's one of them. So what was that experience like?
Larry's a genius and a sweetheart. He's the best. It was very funny. His agent put it, we were crewing up the movie, and we were just like going out to agents and be like, who's around, who's available, you know? And his agent put his name forward. And we were like, yeah, okay, but like, no, but who really wants to shoot the movie, you know? And I didn't believe it, honestly. I think I had like three meetings with Larry where I was like, you're really like, you're sure you want to come do this? Like, because this is going to be down and dirty relative to, you know, Kong Skull Island, or Superman, you know, like, but no, he was really game. He really was excited about it. He liked the formal challenges of like the things that I was interested in talking about to him. And you know, he got very, very into that. And it was a real boon to have someone who's just got so much like creature and spectacle kind of filmmaking experience. And kind of, you know, I think with Larry, I thought the movie was gonna look. It looks a lot more polished in a way than I was expecting. I was like, yeah, we're gonna make a weird thing. And then like you show up with Larry and he's like, oh no, this looks like, because I was like, oh, we can't, like, we're gonna have like a down and dirty or like Raimi kind of thing to it. And then Larry's like, no, I'm gonna make this look gorgeous. And it's like, okay, great, thank you for doing that.
That's awesome.
Obviously we talked a lot about look and develop that, but his, I think Larry's natural mode has such a certain studio feel to it in a good way that I think speaks to the populism of the popcorn cinema that we were trying to capture. So I think that was a nice touch to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of my friends and colleagues recently attended a screening that you guys were at, and there's a post screening Q&A where the cast was there and they were talking about improvising a little bit, and
Yeah.
he was telling me about this, and then you were just telling me that you storyboarded the whole movie and you had, you know, these plans going in. So what was that like as a first time feature director, letting all of these people, I mean, Paul Rudd being the lead of the movie and this incredible world-class improviser, letting people like that just kind of go off on their own and try to bump things up and do their own thing with it and add their own personal magic to it. Like, as a director who presumably doesn't have a ton of time, are you always like checking the clock? And like, what was your kind of thought process of letting them improv versus, all right, we got to get the day done and all of that kind of stuff? How did that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was, we'll just say like the shot list and the storyboarding, like that's all prep that I do and then throw away at some point, you know, as it's like, okay, that's not like, that's not the shot now that we're here. Or now I realize I don't need that. Like I've got something else that's much better now that I didn't expect. And so it's all about having that plan in case you need it or having it as your starting point. And then, you know, you need to kind of find your way through the woods. With the cast, you know, very fortunate in that we did have some, we had like a table read where like, you know, I encouraged the cast to like, hey, play around. Like this is like, I want to hear the rhythm of the scene, but like it doesn't need to be word perfect. I want you to find the best expression of it. And it's funny because that improv can be so many things. But you know, I think the movie has a certain there's a certain propulsiveness of like it has a lot of plot, like there's a lot of story, there's a lot of movements to it. Like every 10, 15 minutes, I like to think like the paradigm shifts, like we just like shift what we're talking about, and the plot kind of pivots. So every scene, you know, there wasn't a lot of like scenes of like, hey, we're all hanging out in this scene and improv on the couch, do whatever. But within that, there's a lot of stuff you can improv of like, you know, the scene, you're gonna hit this beat and then you're gonna hit this beat and then you're gonna hit this beat. But like how you do that, there's a little room to play within that, you know? And so that was something that we definitely did of like, well, what's the best way to hit this beat? What's the funniest way to hit this beat? What's the way that, you know, reveals something with the character in a funny and unexpected way? So there was a lot of that of like, you know, it wasn't this like improv of like, yeah, let's see what happens with the scene. What if you walked over there and, you know, started making a drink? It was more like, hey, this is sort of going to be happening over here and this is sort of going to be happening over here. Like, what's the best way to bridge these moments or what's the best way to, you know, there's a line here, but let's find a better version of the line or maybe it's an omission of the line. You know, the other thing though that we got to do, which was really appreciated, I loved, it was so great. The movie has so many like big dialogue ensemble scenes. And normally on set, what you do is you block a scene at the top of the day. You know, you start your day, you block the scene, and then you show it to the crew, and then the crew lights the scene, and then you come back and you start shooting the scene. Blocking the scene can take, you know, anywhere from half an hour to 3 hours, depending on the scene. It can really get complicated. Our cast was really game, and with our AD, we kind of scheduled it so that we would do a couple big dialogue scenes per week, like two or three usually. And on the Saturday before that week, we would get together on the stage and rehearse that scene. So by the time those two or three scenes, we'd spend that Saturday like 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours, whatever it was. And the whole ensemble, we'd get together and we'd block the next week's big scenes so that we knew on the day. And then Larry would be there, our prop master would be there. So, we'd be like looking at shots and we'd be blocking it out and we'd be figuring out a lot of those things. And that was like a great opportunity to play too. That's where we were like, hey, there's no pressure. There's no gaffer being like, I gotta light this fucking thing in 2 minutes, which is great. That's the gaffer's job. I'm not besmirching our gaffer, bemoaning his duties. But that was a really great time to play, to figure it out. And then when we'd get to set to shoot that week's big dialogue scenes, we were like, within half an hour of showing up, we'd be like, all right, guys, let's like remind ourselves what we did. Let's run the scene a couple times just for ourselves. And then we could show it to the crew pretty much, within half an hour.
Yeah, that's great, man. Okay, well, unfortunately, I'm out of time with you, but congrats on getting this thing across the finish line, man. It's really awesome.
Thanks so much, man. I appreciate it.
Cool, take care. All right, that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about Death of a Unicorn at slashfilm.com. I'm going to link to our review of the movie from South by Southwest in the show notes, so you can find that directly there. Slash Film Daily is typically published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show. Spread the word if you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.
Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to drive smarter with high-tech features and excellent reliability. Check out the Honda Civic, Accord, or HR-V. For a limited time, well-qualified buyers can get a 4.99% APR on a 2025 Civic or a 3.99% APR on a 2025 Accord or HR-V.
See dealer for financing details. Exclude Civic Si and Type R.